C1PH. Number 7A.
We come to the last subject of that first part, which we can symbolize by love. But it isn't just love. It seems as if she would lift up the subject right higher, as if she would lift it up to the plane of divine science, where we know that in divine science love has no consciousness of error, where we can see that love is that concept which makes us realize that error is nothing. It isn't something to be overcome. It is not something which we can ameliorate through metaphysics, nor something which truth overcomes, but love just doesn't know it. It doesn't exist. And so here, this subject all deals with the sense that error, evil, just is nothing. I have epitomized it and said mortal existence is illusionary. A belief which finally always falls back into its native nothingness. It's an interesting thing. See, when Pythagoras investigated the tones of the scale and found out mathematical relationships, he could hear the harmony. He could hear the harmony of that relationship. It wasn't just mathematical relationships which gave a mathematical harmony. He could hear it. And it is said that Kepler, when he found that the planets were moving in a proportion which were the same as those of the tones in music, he could hear the harmony of the spheres. And I feel when we can read the textbook, we can also see it intelligently and say, yes, here in the seventh tone, it's all about the nothingness of evil. But there is a music about it. One can hear, if one contemplates it, one can hear, so to say, the music of how these seven stages evolve and rise to a higher sense, which is very difficult to explain in words. If I tried to explain it in words, I would say we can see that in the first five subjects, it was all turning around that tune of how to improve mortal thought. Then in the sixth, it was another tune, that tremendous tune from above, which says, from God comes all the healing. Truth through its own mind, through its own spirit, through its own soul, through its own principle, its own life, truth and love does overcome error. And then the melody here in the seventh just rises, so to say, to that balm and calm and rest of love, which says there is nothing really to be overcome. All the belief that there is error falls back on itself into its nothingness. He shows this through seven subtones, which just have one aim in view, just to show that we don't have to overcome evil or error, that we don't have to make evil nothing, that not even truth has to make evil nothing, but the higher melody, which just shows it isn't anything. Evil just isn't anything. She begins that tune with mind, showing that evil is nothing, a supposition of the absence of omnipotence. It's mind, the old power, showing that evil has no power, is not omnipotent, but is only a supposition of the absence of that power. It's not even that she won't show here that evil is the absence of good. It's only the suppositional absence, because good can't be absent. So evil is not the absence of good, because good is always omnipotent and omnipresent. It's only the supposition that good could be absent. So, every mortal, she says, must learn that there is neither power nor reality in evil, that it is just a supposition that good may be absent. So we can see that all the evil that seems to exist, exists only in our ignorance, only there. It never exists outside of us. Then, in the second tone of spirit, she gives a sense that evil is unreal. It is self-destructive. See, evil is unreal because spirit is the only reality, the only substance, indestructible substance. So evil is that which supposes that there is a self-destructing force at work. Evil wants to be real. She says it is self-asserting and says, I'm a real entity. But the only power of evil, she says, is to destroy itself, that it can never destroy one iota of good. How often have we said that until we got sick of it instead of healthy? Because we must somehow take these fundamental statements and get them new, fresh, alive, tangible, near, warm. And I think we can't do it any way else than to sit back quietly and instead of fiercely reading and reading the textbook, distilling out of the textbook the backbone, the structure of it. And when we have the structure of it, then sit back and ponder them and think about them and ask questions about these statements. Ask ourselves, do I believe in it? Do I stand for it? Do I practice it? Which means to stand for it, to be constant in it. Do I mean what I read? Is that which I have accepted for a thousand times, is that really me? Is that really what I profess for or not? So, the beginning is always a study, a deep study, a consecrated study, but it's only the beginning. That letter can go dry on us, but it can become warm and alive if we ponder them. If we come out of the sense that science is only interpretation of truth and come into that creative sense of science of which we were speaking during this winter. I feel if that turn is not coming, that Christian Science textbook will grow dead on us, just as a rosary. but that it will really fulfill its purpose if we can lift it out into a creative sense. Into the creative sense, what do I mean by it? I mean by it that if, for instance, we take this chapter and take perhaps one subject a day and devote some time to it, not so much in studying it, but in seeing the build-up of each subject and seeing spiritually, is that reality to me? What does it imply? What does it mean? Is it reality? Is it living? Is it the only thing on which I stand, on which I rely? Then in this way, we begin to broaden out what is written in the textbook. We begin to enlarge it, to elaborate it in our own way, in our own thought, adapted to our own situation. Because each one of us is in a different individual situation, meeting individual problems, meeting individual idiosyncrasies, and so on. So then it will be adapted to the situation. So here we will begin to see the nothingness of evil as just a supposition. First in mind, we would contemplate what it means that evil is only the suppositional absence of the omnipotence of mind. Then thought would go on and ponder round about that point that evil is unreal, that it is only self-destructive. Do we believe that evil is self-destructive? Or don't we see evil and feel it is something? And if only we could knock it down, we destroy it. How could we get rid of that evil? How could we put that out of the world? Why not practice the revelation? And practice the revelation would not mean taking good and trying with good to knock down evil, but to see and enjoy the very fact that every evil is self-destroying. Doesn't that give peace, rest, and not struggle, not warring against evil? Quite something different. Then, in soul, mortal mind is ignorant of itself, and therefore is self-deceiving. It does not know mind, and therefore is an idolater. It is self-deceiving. Mortal mind does not know itself. She makes here a very interesting statement and says that as mortals do not comprehend even mortal existence, mortal existence seems to be an enigma, how ignorant must they be of the all-knowing mind and his creations? If we don't even understand mortal existence, well, how can we understand that which is even bigger and higher, the divine mind and its idea? So she shows it's no use to try to understand either the human universe and the material universe, nor the divine universe and spiritual universe through the methods of human mind. The human mind just can't realize what's going on, because the human mind and the divine mind are on two different levels, and those levels don't communicate with each other. It is like this, you see. Say, if a big helicopter, about 10 men or so, would suddenly land somewhere in the middle of Africa, where some bushmen are living who have never seen anything like that, and they would come with lots of noise and so on and land there, these bushmen would think, oh, this is a ship from heaven, the gods have come down from heaven. They wouldn't be able to explain to themselves what it is, where it comes from, how it is possible. And from then on, when that helicopter has gone away, there would be a great myth going on that the deities have come down from heaven and there were gods here, and that with great noise and so on they left. Why? Because their level of consciousness cannot grasp the level of a materialist scientific consciousness. To us, if a helicopter lands, we say, oh, that's interesting, who has invented that, and how has he done that? Oh, yes, how interesting that he has put these things on, so on, so on, so on, so on. And we begin to reason materially. We can understand it. So, two different planes of consciousness can't communicate. Now, the very same thing is today, that with our human scientific materially scientific, rational consciousness, we cannot understand that higher consciousness, which is the consciousness of the divine mind. It's just as inexplicable to us as the helicopter is explicable to the bushman. It's the same thing. And we don't realize that quite enough. That's why we try to understand science and health with the old structure of consciousness, with the materialist, scientific, logical, rational structure of consciousness, and it can't be done. We must realize what she points out here, that mortal mind is ignorant of itself and self-deceiving. And so the materially scientific consciousness into which we have been educated from the first day we are here, through the school, through the literature, through everything, that this materially scientific consciousness cannot comprehend the science of divine mind. And every attempt to try to do it, to reason out the textbook, will fail. The only way is to have a different structure of consciousness than the usually structure of consciousness which people have today, namely that spiritual consciousness. Only that can understand what's going on divinely, and only that can understand what has gone on a deeper level, namely only the divine mind can rightly judge how valuable and how invaluable the present material scientific consciousness is. I think this has to be made very clear to ourselves, or else we are in danger of trying to understand the Bible and the textbook with a false structure of consciousness. Because Mrs. Eddy says that what she discovered is science, doesn't mean that a scientific mind in the ordinary sense can understand it. Just the contrary. She put to science a capital S, indicating really that what she has discovered is not the same scientific concept of the present age, but a completely different level of consciousness in regard to science. That's why we have to find, through prayer, through Atonement Eucharist, through Chapter on Marriage, through the Chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism especially, we have to find the way to that oneness with the divine mind, which gives us a new scientific consciousness, a completely new structure of consciousness. And only with that structure of consciousness, where our mind is the same mind as the mind of God, where we have no other mind but the mind of God, where we have the mind of Christ, then the revelations of the mind of Christ make sense to us. It is no more materially rational. It is then irrational. I don't know if you know that term, irrational. It is not irrational, but it is not materially rational. It is irrational. It has a reason which is above the logical reason. It has a reason which is born of a revelation. So this subject here really indicates that mortal mind is completely ignorant of the divine mind and cannot fathom the divine mind. That's why I feel that every time we study the Bible and the textbook, every time we study revealed literature, we cannot afford just to read them with the blunt human mind, but that it is so necessary that inwardly we pray and are open to be one with the one mind, and that only that mind, which is one with the divine mind, can understand what the divine mind reveals, and can only hear the revelations of divine mind. We shouldn't forget that the Christian Science textbook starts with prayer. Mostly, when one gets too much interested in the technique and the structure of the system of Christian Science, one loses the sense that we study with prayer, with a prayerful attitude. And the prayerful attitude is that attitude which can only pray with that which is godlike, that can only hear with that which is godlike, that can only be conscious with that which is God-conscious. Then we go on to principle, where she shows that mortal mind governs all actions of the mortal body, both voluntary and miscalled involuntary actions. In science, all actions is governed by the divine mind. It is here where she tries to show in various ways that really mortal mind is impersonal, that it is as well voluntary as well as involuntary mortal mind. That mortal mind has nothing to do if we are conscious of it or unconscious of it. That mortal mind has just the belief that it is working anyway, so that we don't pin it down of being conscious of mortal mind or not conscious of mortal mind. Our lungs and our heart and our kidneys, I'm not allowed to talk about those organs in England, I was told. Heart and lungs, I think that's all right. So we have to see that mortal mind is impersonal and therefore acts as long as it is not checked by science. Only if we check it by science, then mortal mind, being voluntary or involuntary, cannot play its trick on us. So we see again that evil is really an impersonal belief. Then come to life, and here she goes further with the explication of the nothingness of evil and shows that death really doesn't exist. Death exists only in mortal mind. Mortality disappears when mortal mind yields to the divine mind. That death and mortal mind really is one, as we have seen before. Therefore, death isn't something which exists. It exists in mortal mind, and as long, therefore, as we accept death, we will experience death. If we disapprove with death, then we have life. I think we so often forget that death is a human invention. We believe that death is a natural happening, but it isn't. people have formed the concept of death. They have called a certain stage in the development of being death. But it is a human invention. It doesn't exist in being. It doesn't exist anywhere. And this we must be clear about, because we even know that humanly, the human mind believes in eternal life, and that the human mind may wake up after that which is called death and sees that it has not died, and holds on to the beliefs which it had before the death. So death is a human invention. If only we could see that. It doesn't exist. And if we see it as a human invention, we don't try to overcome it as if it were something. But we would lift ourselves right out and see that that which is called death is only a change, just as a healing is a change, just as when we are in a problem and it solves itself, it is a change. So death is just one change of one human consciousness to another state of human consciousness, and has nothing whatever to do with life eternal. It doesn't touch life eternal. Therefore, we have an innate desire to live aright. If we wouldn't believe in eternal life, we wouldn't have a desire to live aright. We would just live as according to our instincts, like an animal. But because we have an instinct sense that which we are doing now is building up our eternal structure, our eternal identity, is part of our individual eternal consciousness. That's why we feel we should live aright. And that is not subject to mortal mind and to death. So death does not exist. As truth, it is shown that disease does not exist. You see, we have all this does not exist. It is always showing that error, whatever form it takes on, whatever evil says it is, that it is a nothing. It does not exist. It is a dream, a growth of error. And Christian Science establishes health. He shows here that disease is really a dream. It's a mental concept. That's why in dreams we can be very healthy when we are not healthy. That's why in dreams we can be very sick when we are very healthy. The dream can give us the impression, the sensation of something which is completely contrary to the facts. Now, our human consciousness is also a dream. It isn't a wake state. Our present consciousness, our present state of consciousness, is not yet that consciousness which has awakened out of its deep dream. You know how mankind, through the last 100,000 years around about, since the birth of the Homo sapiens, has come steadily to a higher realization, to a higher brightness, to a higher light of consciousness. That 100,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, man was much more in a state of dream and of a dream life than he is now. But to think that today we are quite awake is just fooling ourselves. Why should we now be quite awake if we can see that it has taken hundreds of thousands of years just to bring more light steadily into a dream consciousness, into a very deep dream consciousness as our forefathers had. And to think that we have already awoken to the full light is just fooling ourselves.